And so I don't think people take the fact whether Bush told the lie very seriously, because they don't think he really had any initiative in the process. He was merely reflecting whatever was put in front of him. And I return to California under the dark shadow of Arnold Schwarzenegger. I personally rejoiced in the result. I want to make that absolutely clear. I thought Davis was an absolutely miserable son of a bitch, and I completely exult in his defeat. And there may be some Democrats in the room, or people who thought they were radicals until they saw Davis in danger, and I'd like to dispute with them eagerly at any time. I think what we've seen in the last week is the absolute decisive evidence that there will be no third-party resistance in next year's election. That I had thought, as I've pathetically hoped for many, many years now, that some vibrant third force would emerge in American politics. There are many vibrant third forces in our political culture, but as they came down to the wire, what did we see in this recent go-round with the recall and Schwarzenegger? We saw Medea Benjamin and those people fleeing back into the Democratic camp, deserting Camejo. We saw Arianna Huffington, whose political career is absolutely astounding from having been wedded to a Texan fascist, and then suddenly discovered the Third Way, and then deserted the Third Way and returned to the Second Way, which is the same as the First Way, which is the same old way. And so even in Santa Cruz County, you would have thought the bedrock of third-party exceptionalism in California, unless you actually happen to have been there, Camejo got, I think, 16% of the vote. That's it. So, I mean, let's not have any illusions about next year. You can talk all you want. Everybody, if the Democrats select Wesley Clark, you know, a Republican general, and a madman to boot, they'll all vote for him. We will see Medea Benjamin, we'll see absolutely everybody saying it is essential to beat off the forces of fascism and George Bush, we have to vote for Wesley Clark. So just get used to it, that's all I say. Now the book, sorry, I just had to get that off my chest right at the start. And we can come back to it. We don't have to stick to the subject, you know. We're not on the Lera show. I did a really good parody once of MacNeil Lehrer. It's in the Corruptions of Empire, my collection in there. Yeah, it was really good. It's one of the best parodies ever written. I say that myself, but it's in there. When they were going to have St. Peter on. And he tries to read from the book of Isaiah, and he keeps saying we're running out of time. Now, this book comes from the heart. I'll be a little autobiographical here. I came to America in 1972, 3 weeks before the Watergate break-in, for the very old people in the crowd. And went to work for the Village Voice. And about 1975... I remember I read a little thing about a revenge raid on a refugee camp in Lebanon by the Air Force of Israel. And it was, you know, a four-line item in the Times, you know, Israeli jets today bombarded some camp in revenge for some... I think that someone had fired from the Golan Heights or something, not hit anybody, and they'd gone and raided the camp and, you know, smashed it up and killed 30 people or something. And I wrote I was writing a press column in the Village Voice at the time, and I sort of said, you know, there might be a little bit of balance here. How about, you know, maybe some reporter might one day go to the camp, you know, and see how many people have been killed and, you know, flesh it out a little bit. And Dan Wolf, who was the founder and editor of the Village Voice, pulled the item. Our censorship was virtually unknown at the Village Voice. No one ever read half the stuff that ever went into it, you know. I remember what Jill Johnson used to write. She was the feminist, in-house feminist, and she didn't believe in capital letters or paragraphs. Which is fine by me, you know. But it was a fairly solid, you know, whack of print. And one day, I thought, I'm going to read this goddamn thing. And I read, it was about 3,000 words long, and it did not make sense. It just didn't. No matter how you tried, you could not make sense of Jill Johnson. And I finally figured out that it had been glued up wrong. And I went to the person. In those days, you know, you ran the galleys through and it was waxed up and then you slapped it on, waxed it, and then photographed it. And I said, you know, you waxed the columns the wrong way around. And he said, oh my God, I did. And you could see where one column went down and then there was a sort of, you know, a certain change of theme at the top, change of vowel sound. And I said, don't say a word. Don't say a word. And we'll see if anybody notices, including Jill Johnson. Not a word. Went straight through. So in this Village Voice, which where Jill Johnson could have 3,000 words of absolutely unfathomable prose, and Jonas Mekas, and again, the older folk among us will remember those great days, one little item about Israeli jets bombarding a refugee camp was pulled. I was pretty astounded. And I said to Dan, whom I was tight with, you know, a very nice man, I said, well, you know, why are you pulling this item? And he said, it just seemed out of key. And, the Village Voice congressman was Ed Koch, subsequently the mayor of New York. And he just said, it just seemed out of place in your kind of style, Alex. So I said, well, I don't know, I'm fairly contentious. I can't see why it's out of place. And so then I wrote a longer piece the next week. And he couldn't very well just say it was out of key, because the first one was about 3 lines long. This one was about 80 lines long. So he looked rather morose, and in it went. And then I began to sort of try and write about the issue, which in New York in those days, you must remember that this was a time when the New York Times used to delightedly quote Golda Meir, Prime Minister of Israel, saying there are no Palestinians. They do not exist. Not that they should be thrown into the sea, but they'd actually know physically and historically and ethnographically and politically and aesthetically and in every other way, they don't exist at all. Bunch of Arabs who should be forgotten and, if possible, kicked out. And then this was also the era in which, after Golda Meir's rather abrupt dismissal of the existence of the Palestinians, there was Joan Peters, who wrote a book called From Time Immemorial, came out in the very early 80s, ecstatically greeted by the New York Times, an incredibly long review, saying, profoundly important book, saying actually all the Palestinians in Israel come really late, like in about 1930. And they'd really become because of Zionist initiatives. Israel had been completely empty, basically since biblical times, and an occasional British tourist or, you know, the odd film crew from Hollywood, but about, you know, Lloyd Douglas writing The Robe went through and that kind of thing. But no one there at all. And then, you know, then whoever it was said, a land without people for a people without land, the famous Zionist thing at the end. And then, you know, industrious Zionists came in and made the desert bloom and made the cities hum. And then, you know, Arabs, noses crinkling at the opportunity, came rushing in. That was her thesis, which was nobly reviewed in the New York Times. It's a marvelous book, very sound. She had lots of footnotes. They were all nonsense, except the only standing they have in the world is they were all copied by Alan Dershowitz in his recent book, including all the mistakes. Amazing. If you want to see it on the Counterpunch website, I just did a review of it, all the mistakes. Dershowitz, you know, a tricky lawyer, of course, said, well, I read the original sources. I didn't copy it out of Joan Peters. But then he had a tricky... Norman Finkelstein discovered that when Peters made a mistake, like she said the following passage from Mark Twain, but she didn't realize that the passage from Mark Twain was actually two different things separated by about 500 pages. and other things. Dershowitz always copied the same thing. And that was exposed as a fraud in the middle 80s. And so I went along, and I finally regarded myself as a kind of counterweight to the torrent of the absolute acceptance that Israel had the state of Israel had the right to do what it wanted. Palestinians had no existence, no historical validity, and could be bombed and obliterated as the situation called for. And then about middle 70s, I got it in the neck from Jack Newfield, who was the big mucky-muck at the Village Voice in those days. He wrote a sort of swollen-chested sort of populist style, you know, two-fisted. New York is completely cursed by the two-fisted combative columnist style. They're sort of so throttled with their manliness they can barely write, and they certainly can't think. But really terrible stuff. I mean, nice people, but Pete Hamill, you know, I mean, incredibly stupid. And the only one who's quite good is Breslin, actually, of all people, but the curse of the manly style. And Newfield really went at me, and he said I was an anti-Semite. That's the first time I'd ever been called an anti-Semite. So I was kind of taken aback and hurt and dismayed. And thought, what have I done? You know, I, like everybody else, I'd grown up, you know, raging against the treatment of Jews by Hitler, and, you know, reading all the books about the camps, and, you know, actually rather supportive of the State of Israel, because I hadn't thought about it at all. Growing up in Ireland, where, you know, there were no Palestinians and no Jews and no black people and just Irish people. And so I then had to pull myself together and read madly to try and justify my prose and attack Newfield. And it was one of those things that, you know, I replied in force over thousands of words, and then he replied in more force over more thousands of words, and then I replied, and then everyone got so bored, I think the whole thing died. But it was a real wake-up call for me, and I noticed then, and it wasn't used as much as it is now, that whenever the going got rough, and you said, well, I think, you know, I'm going to write such and such a thing about, or you call, let's say, Begin a fascist, and you'd go back, and Menachem Begin, Prime Minister of Israel back in the time of Jimmy Carter. And you'd say, you know, then you'd go back to Begin's background in Lithuania as a fascist, and then you'd quote Hannah Arendt and Albert Einstein's denunciation of Begin as a fascist and the Herut Party, his party, as a fascist party, published in the New York Times in the late 40s. You'd go through all this stuff, and at the end of the day, they'd say this is anti-Semitic ravings. And so you could see how the process was working. And then you'd painstakingly write a piece saying, look, there is a thing called anti-Semitism, and, you know, this is not it. To criticize the State of Israel, to criticize Menachem Begin, is not anti-Semitic. It has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. And you could see then, I think now the process become much more automatic. In those days when they threw the charge at you, it was that they did it with a certain, you know, well, all right, you're an anti-Semite. You know, and it was a little sort of, they were so aware that it was a little meretricious. And now it's become much easier. I mean, I got called an anti-Semite by Eric Alterman for attacking Irving Howe, which seems like a tremendous decline in the status of anti-Semitism. From the darkest days of the Middle Ages to saying a dirty thing about Irving Howe, and you're an anti-Semite. And you're the same as, you know, the people who said that the Jews drank the blood of Christian children in the 14th century, which Scott will be dealing with in a minute. But it went on. And the rough rule, which I say, and I'll read the first line. I never believe in reading out of a book at a meeting like this, because first of all, the writer and then the audience go to sleep. But let's see. Page 21. There's always a tricky moment when you discover the pages are wrong. But in this case, it's... There we go. Look. That's the first page. Over the past 20 years, I've learned there's a quick way of... Oh, it's all right. I thought it was a misprint already. Over the past 20 years, I've learned there's a quick way of figuring out just how badly Israel is behaving. You see a brisk uptick in the number of articles here accusing the left of anti-Semitism. And that is about it. That now, and I'm going to skip, I've left us in, I think, 1982. No, I didn't even get to 1982. I think I got to 1978. And we're going to go right forward to this year. And in question time, we can deal with the intervening period. month by month if necessary. And here we have a situation where you have Sharon, certified war criminal and mass murderer, with a career of bloodshed and infamy going back to the 40s and 50s, running Israel, and clearly, you know, his record is open to see back in the 50s, it's open to see during the 82 invasion of Lebanon, it's open to see in his provocations by setting up a house in East Jerusalem, and every turn. And here you have, you know, a daily diet of, you know, Palestinian houses being smashed down, orchards being uprooted, you know, the fence going through. I mean, of course, you know, there's the demolitions, and then you see the murder of Rachel Corrie, and, you know, the revenge, in my view, ghastly suicide bombings. But, you know, you see this cycle, but you see a cycle instigated in this instance clearly by Sharon and by the Likud party. And just at that moment, it's really cranking up. You saw a tremendous uptick in articles about the anti-Semitism of the left in the United States, which I think is an absolute fantasy, a fantasy from beginning to end. We've been running on the Counterpunch website a bunch of articles about that, and we've been running articles about, you know, what is the real power of the lobby in this country, the Israel lobby? And there is a dispute about it. Someone like Chomsky, for example, says the power of the Israel lobby is minute. What you've got to look at is the power of the American state. And the Israel lobby is a grace note to the power of the American state. And actually, Jeff Blankfort, in a very interesting piece in this book, takes issue with that in a respectful way to Chomsky. I'm sure Noam has got a skin like tissue paper, just like Saeed will get very pissed off, but I think it's a serious article. And there is a marvelous article by the late Edward Said, talking about a really, you know, in the spirit of binationalism, a very generous and magnificent article, and various other approaches. Out of interest, actually, it's written half by people of Jewish origin and half not. We've got Lenny Brenner, we've got Norman Finkelstein, what's that, Norman making a sort of spectral entry, but going to Germany with his book, his book, The Holocaust Industry, and being attacked. He can't attack him as an anti-Semite, but I guess as a self-hating Jew, and the book is a series of about 14 essays, Robert Fisk and people like that. And I think it covers, very seriously, a pretty interesting political terrain, which is the issue of what is anti-Semitism and what is anti-Zionism, and how this strategy of besmirching people in this country who are critics of what Israel is up to is done. It discusses the power of the lobby. It discusses specific incidents. Jeff Sinclair, my co-editor of Counterpunch, goes through the attack on the Liberty in the late 60s as an astounding example of the power of the lobby, where there was a U.S. Navy ship which was attacked by Israeli jets, and over many U.S. servicemen were killed, and how the whole issue was hushed up. So it goes on. There's a very striking essay on the power of the lobby on the Hill. So it's not totally on the theme of anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism. It inspects this whole phenomenon from a number of points of view. I think the book is important, really, if it launches a real discussion on the left or on, on the radical, progressive, or any really area of how we can really deal with such attacks as this and get on with a serious discussion of how the progressive forces here should confront the issue of justice for Palestinians, what we think a just solution in the Middle East should be, and how we have to, you know, confront not only, the truly demented sort of Christian fundamentalist Zionist alliance now being spearheaded by Bush, but, you know, the equivalent performance by the Democrats in a different way. I mean, it really made me laugh to see Arnold Schwarzenegger, an effort to go after him for being a Nazi. I mean, I think Arnold Schwarzenegger's an awful fellow, but I don't think you have to, like, strap Mein Kampf around his neck to get the essence of the guy. I just don't think it's not the key to Arnold, if you know what I mean. And, I mean, he did say in his famous interview in Elle, I mean, We Magazine. I mean, does anyone really remember We Magazine? OUI, published by Guccione, where he did this interview in the 70s after he'd done Pumping Iron. It's now being studied as though it was a, you know, Aristotle. This is We Magazine. And Arnold is probably sitting there in New York being interviewed, probably high as a kite, by someone, you know, and Arnold sort of just like, and he, little did he know that keen eyes in 2003 would be scrutinizing every sentence to obtain keys to his political personality. Actually, he said he rather admired Hitler for getting really big crowds. He could see him as a crowd puller. And that's what he liked. He said he didn't really agree with what Adolf said. But anyway, what makes me laugh is here is this discussion, you know. And the English papers, they had these immensely, the return of fascism, you know. And then they said, Arnold Schwarzenegger was very funny. They also said the most famous Austrian since Mozart. Since Mozart. It's that old joke, you know, the Austrian's great skill. They make, you know, what people think that Beethoven was Austrian and Hitler was a German. But meanwhile, you have, you know, Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer voting, you know, week after week, month after month, year after year, every credit to Israel to go and murder Palestinians, every weapon of war you can find, every obstruction in the path of a decent negotiation, every approval of land being stolen by the wall, you name it, they voted for it. I mean, Barbara Boxer as much as Dianne Feinstein. And Barbara Boxer is now endorsing an attack on Syria. And then you see these people, you know, getting all worried. What?
And Barbara Lee.
And Barbara Lee. Well, maybe can add a contribution there. I don't know about Barbara Lee, but
she votes for all of them.
Okay, there you go. And then for people then to get sidetracked from the reality of it by whether Arnold, you know, memorized page 3 of Mein Kampf is absolutely preposterous and shows the level of, not false labeling, but just sort of caricature that any serious consideration of the issue can be done. The issue of these candidates, if you want to see a truly degraded performance by that beast called man, that's Jonathan Swift, yes. Look at the Democratic candidates. I'm sure you have. I've just told you, you've got no choice on the third party front, so you will have to, your gaze has to swivel back now, not only to the splendid form of Wesley Clark, the Napoleon of America, but I guess, all right, Napoleon, that sounded good. And then, but Howard Dean, who many people are persuading themselves that Howard Dean, oh, I heard a little hiss there. Did I hear a hiss for Dean? Everyone hiss for Dean? Oh, yeah, good. Howard Dean, now being greeted as the great hope of progressive forces. You know, Dean, who, anyone here from Vermont? Any refugees from the mountain, Green Mountain State? No? Not a single Vermonter. I mean, Dean has now been reinvented as a progressive governor of Vermont. He was not a progressive governor of Vermont. He was a very regressive governor of Vermont, with many infamous performances to his name. He managed to deny the state a very promising effort at universal health care. He managed to sink medical marijuana, which was going through. He managed to come out for the death penalty. He came out late for the death penalty. When he was running for the presidency of the United States, he came out for the death penalty for if people kill policemen and small children. If you're an elderly lady, you know, who cares? But policemen and kids. And he's widened it since to include terrorists who presumably kill anybody, but, you know, hell. And but his main campaign guy was the former head of AIPAC. Every candidate you'll see on the Democratic side will do nothing other than a full-throated endorsement of anything that the U.S. will give Israel, anything that Israel does. And we just have to speak up with all the vigor we can and really use this time when I think there is the potential for building a larger movement for justice for Palestinians than at any time I can remember. Because people, you know, it's one thing when you've got someone, you know, the Oslo, the process going forward, you've got Rabin or you, whoever. It's another thing when you've got an utterly insensate, you know, fascist government in charge of Israel doing what it's doing. So if the time isn't ripe for us to, you know, beef up a movement for justice for Palestinians, when will it be? And I hope this book will serve the function of giving people a little octane in the tank and powerful arguments when they're confronted with, you know, vulgar and stupid charges that they're being anti-Semitic or whatever it is. And people are worried about those charges. And so that's what I think the virtue of this book is. And now it's my tremendous pleasure in introducing a contributor to the book. He didn't get paid for it, which shows that he's completely disinterested. Scott Handelman, whom I've known for many years since he came and worked with me at The Nation magazine. And Scotty is completing his law studies here in Berkeley. And he's written many times on the Counterpunch website. He spent much time in Chiapas. And he did an article in this book which he'll describe. So I'm going to give the floor for a moment to Scott.
Hi, good evening. There we go. So what I wrote for this book was a book review on of another book on anti-Semitism, but a bad one. Not like the politics of anti-Semitism is the one to get, obviously. But I wrote a review of this book called Anti-Semitism: Myth and Hate from Antiquity to the Present, and let me just quote from it for a second. The authors say, there are a couple of historians, Jewish history professors at various universities. They say, the exacerbation of the Arab-Israeli conflict has generated a resurgence of anti-Semitism in Europe, even among polite circles. In demonstrations held in many European cities in support of the Palestinians, Israelis were equated with Nazis, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon with Hitler, and the Israeli flag was burned. What is most distressing is the way the press and intellectuals, who previously glossed over the Israeli casualties of suicide bombers, were quick to condemn Israel, often sinking into the ordure of anti-Semitism. Accepting as true the grotesque Palestinian fabrication that a massacre had taken place at Jenin, the press in several countries accused the Israeli army of engaging in genocide. So that's what these guys said. And so essentially, if you read what they're saying that every comment that first of all, they say that that the Jenin massacre was a grotesque fabrication. So in doing that. In their book, they also have a chapter where they talk about their modern-day anti-Semites, and one of the big categories of modern-day anti-Semites are the Holocaust deniers. And when they're describing the characteristic mode of operation of the Holocaust denier, they say, chronicles written by Jews are disqualified as evidence. So here and there, but then when they're talking about the Palestinians, they say they're automatically discounting a Palestinian story, Palestinian narrative as evidence. They're saying that can't be true. That came from Palestinians. So I think what that reflects is a level of obviously of racism, which racism against Palestinians, which is. Which is the inversion of the racism that was experienced by Jews up until World War II. Anti-Semitism is a phenomenon that is basically a racial phenomenon ever since the 19th century. It arose out of hatred of Jews, but then with the development of eugenics. and scientific notions of race. In the 19th century, anti-Semitism developed as a completely different and separate phenomenon. And it's a phenomenon which has historical roots and which has historical reasons why it occurred. It's a phenomenon which therefore doesn't exist as this immutable thing out there in the air. And one of the problems with this book and with a lot of the scholarship you can find on anti-Semitism is that anti-Semitism is treated as this immutable kind of immovable mountain, which is treated as something completely different from all the other kinds of racism that are out there. And all the other kinds of hatred of different groups. Treated as different, as a unique thing in its own category, incomparably bad. When I was growing up, I grew up in Miami Beach, Florida, which has a very large Jewish community. I'm Jewish on my mother's side, and I spent a lot. Like my grandfather was a big pro-Israel philanthropist, so I schlepped along to a lot of a speech by Benjamin Netanyahu and various Holocaust memorials and commemorations, and so I've talked to a lot of older Jewish people at these events, and the mentality that exists is that there is this incomparable thing that happened, the Holocaust, which no other evil that ever has occurred in the world before or since can ever compare to. And the problem with that is that it makes Jews into these victims, ahistorical way, who then can do no wrong when they turn when they're doing what they do over in Palestine. So you see this incredible double standard. Actually, today, anti-Semitism has become a totally marginal phenomenon. You know, there's about 250 Holocaust memorials scattered around the world, and Germany and Austria have made payments in a way that other ethnic groups that have been victims of persecution haven't received aid. So, whose interest does this serve? This libel of saying that if you're opposing Israel, you're an anti-Semite. Well, obviously, it's serving the interests of Israel, of the Zionists, of the people who are defending what Israel does. It's also serving an interest of this oligarchy that controls the Jewish thought. Claims to speak for Jews in the United States. The groups like the American Jewish Council, the Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish National Fund, all these groups are groups of older, wealthy Jews who claim they speak in the mind of Jews as a whole, and in whose interest it is to pretend that anti-Semitism is a huge phenomenon. So there was a survey they conducted just in 2002 where they said that there are 35 million Americans are strongly anti-Semitic, which, when you think about it for a minute, is ridiculous. That's like 1 in 8 Jews. 1 in 8 Americans. And speaking as a Jewish person walking down the street, I've never encountered an anti-Semitic episode. So where are all these anti-Semites? Are they all living in Idaho or whatever? I don't think so. The closest thing was I was in Tijuana earlier this summer, and I was staying with a very nice guy, a Jehovah's Witness fellow, who asked me if it was true that when I said I was Jewish, was it true that Jews were, all Jews were wealthy and really good at making money. But he had never met a Jew before. So, that seems like a reasonable question. if it's something that you've heard from, I said, no, that's not true. There are a lot of poor Jews. And then the next day he was trying to buy me breakfast. it's not really a common phenomenon. So they claim there are 35 million anti-Semites out there. That's serving their interests. Meanwhile, the hypocrisy of the Anti-Defamation League in just last month, in September. They had an awards dinner, and they honored the Prime Minister of Italy, Silvio Berlusconi. And in accepting the award, Berlusconi said, "I pledge total commitment to the fight against anti-Semitism, et cetera, et cetera." But, you know, a week previously, Berlusconi said, he was quoted as saying, back in Italy, he said, "Mussolini never killed anyone. Mussolini used to send people on vacation in internal exile." the truth is that Mussolini's regime issued a lot of anti-Semitic laws starting in about 1938, and then after he died in 1943, when Germany occupied Italy, they sent about 7,000 Jews to the death camps. So, which was made possible by all the stuff that Mussolini had been putting out there. So. That shows a hypocrisy on part of the ADL. But why was the ADL really honoring Berlusconi? Obviously not for being such a big opponent of anti-Semitism. They were honoring Berlusconi because he's a strong friend and supporter of Israel. The people who are talking about Israel, are talking about anti-Semitism, decrying anti-Semitism, shouting about it, and shouting about anyone who's against the atrocities of the Israeli government, calling those people anti-Semites. Meanwhile, supporting someone who's a real apologist for anti-Semites. That shows that what's really going on is that Israel has come to trump. Israel has come to beca- has become more important. Supporting Israel has become more important than the safety of Jews in the world. The original reason for the founding of Israel was we're going to make the world safer for Jews. Well, nowhere in the world right now are Jews more likely to be killed for being Jewish than in Israel, where they have a high risk of being a victim of suicide bombs. But also, the reality is that Israel has become such a shibboleth for the leaders of the American Jewish community that even if you're an anti-Semite, as long as you're good with supporting Israel, you're all right. But if you're a critic of Israel, it doesn't matter that you're a proud Jew and an uncompromising Jew, then you're denounced as an anti-Semite. So that's pretty much what my book review is about. I'll turn it back over to Alex.
Thank you, Ted.
Yeah. Well, good. I think we might even throw it open to questions. So does anyone want to... Did people at the back hear the question? The questioner was saying that the population, proportion of Jews in this country per population is pretty small, and how do we explain the apparently visceral or general, almost reflexive support of Israel by the bulk of by a very large number of non-Jewish Americans, right?
Yes, with the exception of the right-wing fundamentalists, the words of their theocracy, but the rest of them, they don't have any dogmatic basis for
right. Well, I mean, I'm interested to hear other people's views and Scotty's views. My own feeling would be that a lot of people, first of all, the discussion in the press and in schools and colleges, in the educational system, and in what passes for general political discourse in this country, aces out occludes and conceals, you know, the realities in the Middle East today. I think anyone most, I think this is diminishing a little bit. But, you know, growing up, how much do you actually learn about what's actually going on in Palestine, Israel, whatever you want to say, in the Middle East? It's virtually invisible, as the Palestinians were as invisible, as I said, in the 70s. And then many people, you know, they know about the Final Solution. They've read about the Final Solution. They've had a lot of stuff about the Holocaust. They know that, you know, millions and millions of Jews perished in the gas chambers. And I think a lot of people still feel that's it. You know, anywhere the Jews go, I mean, I'm going to favor a sanctuary. I think they are thinking of that level, and that's why they support. That would be a one just very basic reaction, I think, that my view. But you've put your hand up immediately. You mean they all think that we settled and wiped out Indians and they're wiping out Palestinians?
Yes.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all.
Well, he makes an interesting argument.
Well, I bet he does. I respect Norman, but I don't agree with that. I mean, so everyone who says, they think my great-grandfather killed an Indian or drove an Indian off.
There's a land that this chosen people takes over, a people that's different from other people. The myth of their perfect society is so beautiful that everyone wants to believe in it, and the truth is so ugly, no one wants to pay attention to that, and it's parallel in both instances.
Oh, it might be true.
I think it might be. I mean, I think it might also be just that you know, Israelis are by and large white people. I mean, there are a lot of Jews from Arab countries too, but I mean, I think it has to do with, it might just be a racial identification, and then the way they're treated, and they're, you know, they have a higher standard of living, they're more like us, and then they get, every time they get, Israelis get a hit in the media, there's like there's a lot of press attention that you know, when there's a suicide bombing, there's like a human interest story, and Americans can easily relate to those people, whereas Palestinians never have their story really told in a human interest kind of way, right? It's just like these kind of like teeming masses of brown people kind of a thing is the way they get treated in the press.
Well, I think Norris Finkelstein's argument is more that it's a parallel
cycle of pathology. Certainly also there is the whole, of course, the development of the oil industry, certainly in the post-war period, where you see the formation of the State of Israel along with the formation of the building of the Red Sea pipeline, the formation of Aramco, the shift from coal to diesel on the rails, the bituminous coal agreement in 1952 that breaks the power of the UNWA, the National Highway Building Program, the general shift in energy in basically the advanced industrialized countries, or certainly the United States, away from coal to oil. And indeed, the whole creation of Israel as an agent or on-site representative of oil interests in restructuring the energy industry in the mid part of the century, which indeed is the same argument that I think in a different way is being posed today about what is happening with Iraq and restructuring of the Middle East in whatever way the planners of U.S. energy policy or worldwide energy policy have today, and the role of Israel, again, as the hegemonic power in the region that can, as they say, project power, again, in the interests of the recolonization or reconquering of the oil fields. And that is perhaps one reason why
the
power of the, and goes to the debate, by the way, as to, you know, what is the power of the Israel lobby? What exactly is the is that
right
debate about, and the questions that arises? But
we can come back to that. Maybe I can see some other you.
Yeah, I was
maybe because are people at the back hearing these contributions? You can hear it back there. If you can't, give a holler.
I was kind of going along the same, you know, ideas. It seems like, is anybody gathering information about Israel maybe just being a military base for the U.S. industrialists and military-industrial complex?
Yeah, well, that's been a...
set up there as a military base.
I mean, that's been a line in criticisms of Zionism long. Well, what do you? I mean, what? I mean, you're talking about what? Well, what kind of evidence do you want?
Because it seems like from what
I've. I mean, there's actually I can point to a terrific book by my brother and sister-in-law, Dangerous Liaison. Andrew and Leslie Coburn, which is exactly on this subject. Pretty good book. I mean, yeah, but it's been a long-term charge that Israel is the forward base of U.S. imperialism. I mean,
yeah, it's been said. $4 billion a year in
well,
military.
Yeah, basically paying for it all. And basically, it was set up right after the war to get the resources that everybody was after, the oil pipeline.
Well, one of the major resources was $4 million to the Democratic Party. When Truman had his back to the wall against Dewey, and, you know, he got a lot of Jewish money in a paper bag, actually.
I wanted to add to this issue of, I guess, as I understand it, the romantic identification with Israeli Jews. And I believe that the last two fellows gave, good practical reasons why we might want to, the United States government might want to support Israel. But back to what I think are some of the emotional